This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello, and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, if we were villains, what Shakespeare has to say to a modern audience.
So this really came about because Jules can't get Shakespeare out of her head.
Yeah, I don't know why. It was just every time we were trying to come up with a podcast episode today, all that kept coming to mind was Shakespeare quotes and other bits of insanity. So that's where we are.
Bill wouldn't leave us alone. And to be honest, actually, Shakespeare has been on my mind quite recently as well. So it did feel like, I mean, we've skirted around Shakespeare. He's made a brief appearance on the show a few times.
It's really hard to discuss anything at all literary without bumping into Shakespeare, to be honest, because Shakespeare pretty much did everything.
Yeah, I mean, he's just, you know, we mention Roland Barthes every now and again, the fact that he's rolling in his grave. Shakespeare isn't rolling in his grave. I don't think he's been in his grave for a very long time.
No, he flits
around. He's just gallivanting about. He's just gallivanting about the countryside.
Like St. Cuthbert's bones.
Just, yep, being hella gay together. Not that St. Cuthbert is gay. I don't know, maybe
well,
St. Cuthbert.
Maybe, we don't know, but okay, that's gone to a very weird place very quickly, so well done.
Well, we are discussing Shakespeare, and Shakespeare is all about the weird and the wonderful. So, I guess it's been a few centuries, Jules. It's been a few centuries since Shakespeare kind of played his part.
Thank you for adding that context, because the way you said it's been a few centuries made it sound like I've known you for a few hundred years now, Jules, and I really just haven't got around to talking to you about Shakespeare.
Well, I mean, there is also that. We have known each other for a few hundred years, being the immortals that we are.
Yes.
In a previous life, we were siblings. But anyway, Shakespeare, you know, played his part a few hundred years ago. And yet, to this day, he is one of the most beloved English writers in the world.
Yes. And the irony of that is we don't really know who he was. There are several theories, but there is a theory that I completely reject the theory that Christopher Marlowe wrote all Shakespeare's plays under the pseudonym Shakespeare, because that's just ridiculous if you've read any Marlowe. But there's a suggestion that they're not all written by the same person. And again, I would reject that, because if you read them, they seem to me to be either the same group of people writing them or the same person writing them.
Yeah.
Whether it was actually Shakespeare or it was a pseudonym, that mm-hmm. remains open, because the sort of level of education you would have needed to receive in order to be able to write in the way that the person who was the author of the plays and sonnets, etc., did, would have been pretty much of a lord's son, a very classical education.
At the same time, however, because I agree with you, on a logical sense that is true, but it's not the first time that someone of a very low class, we'll say, an impoverished or a lower social background has actually produced work to incredibly high level without a formal education.
Oh no, I'm not saying that you would have had to have a formal education, but you would have had to have access to that sort of, you literally could not have written about the classics and the Greeks, etc., or history, without having some access to the knowledge in the first place. So yeah, it could have been somebody from a very low background.
Yeah. But I mean, the alternative of that is that actually, yeah, he did write about the classics, but he did bastardise them quite a lot.
Yes, but I suppose the thing is, it's a bit like singing, whereby if you want to deliberately sing off-key, you have to be quite a skilled singer in the first place.
Yeah,
and it's the same with bastardising something in such a way that it still retains sense and, that you're presenting it as a twist on the original. You have to actually understand the material in the first place.
Yeah.
So anyway, I think we don't know who he was.
We don't know who he was. There are lots of theories. I kind of reject the idea that it must have been a lord's son or something like that, simply because, I just feels a little bit like It just feels a little bit sort of like, no, no, someone of that class couldn't have possibly written this sort of stuff. Ha ha ha, commoners. No. Which kind of just does seem to, just the idea that, yeah, someone couldn't have done that, even though they were. And yeah, there is an element of access to knowledge and stuff like that. But access could be gained in other ways. And this was, well, I was going to say this was Shakespearean Britain. Surprise, surprise.
Really?
it was actually a time of kind of renovation and change where science was coming through and you know, they were having their first little sort of, ooh, my goodness, knowledge boost, as it were, before everything went to Ratchet, Cromwell. Sorry.
Yes.
I'm not bitter.
It was the end of the Renaissance, and that's something that is covered in the plays as well.
Exactly. So, you know, it was an interesting time for knowledge, and it was an interesting time of being able to make yourself. And that is actually a kind of a theme that we do see a little bit within Shakespeare, the idea of making oneself. But anyway, I think the ultimate question that we're going to have to start with is, what is Shakespeare to you, Jules?
That's difficult because that's okay. The first play I ever read was The Merchant of Venice, and I was 9 years old.
Okay, which Jules,
which perhaps doesn't really answer your question, but I suppose the thing is, he first introduced me to complex ideas on morality, which sounds insane from someone who was raised Roman Catholic and had literally read the Bible from cover to cover in about three different versions because she was looking for some sort of answers. And the Merchant of Venice was probably quite a heavy one to start with, and it's always stayed quite a favourite of mine.
What was the first Shakespeare play you saw?
I'm trying to think whether that was... I don't think I actually saw a Shakespeare play performed until I was 13.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got a feeling that was The Merchant of Venice, and I deliberately went to see it because I'd read the play back when I was 9. I'd read several of the others by then, and most of the sonnets as well. Well, the thing was, I was perpetually looking for something to read. I was always running out of books, and we had this 200-year-old copy of The Complete Works of William Shakespeare that I didn't know if I was actually allowed to touch. So some of my earliest memories include taking that and our old copy of the Canterbury Tales and our old copy of collected English poetry. They must have been some of these must have been my dad's, and mm-hmm. hiding under the dining room table with them for hours so that I could read.
You're such a nerd.
I've always been a complete nerd.
I say that with all the greatest affection, Jill. For me, the first real experience I had with Shakespeare, I think there was a school play of Macbeth at one point, which I sort of saw bits of. But for me, my first real Shakespeare performance I saw was Hamlet. And I've been in a couple of Shakespeare, I've performed Shakespeare since then. But Hamlet for me was the first experience. And I remember being terrified. And I must have been about 9, maybe 10 years old. No, I think I was 9 years old when I saw Hamlet. And that beginning with the ghost, with Hamlet's father, spoilers, guys. I mean, Shakespeare works have been around for longer than you have, so you know what? There are no spoiler warnings here. We're going to be talking about Shakespeare. but the beginning, I was terrified. I was really, really scared. And interestingly enough, before I actually saw that performance, my dad got these special tickets where you could go and have an experience with the actors before you actually saw the play.
Yeah.
And they performed the scene with Ophelia when she's arguing with Hamlet, having just had a conversation with her father and I think her... It's not her brother.
I thought it was Polonius.
She's there like, are you... I think it was Polonius, yeah. She's like, I think you're going crazy. He's there like, get thee to a nunnery. And was super rude.
God hath given you one face, and yet you make for yourselves another.
Yes.
Don't use makeup, girls.
But, yeah, it was a fantastic scene, because what the actors did was that they said, in this part, it would just be Ophelia and Hamlet on stage, but they kept the other two actors on stage as well. And what they did was that they physically restrained Ophelia the whole time.
Yeah.
And the actress who was playing Ophelia was constantly trying to break forward so that she could run to Hamlet and basically throw her arms around him and, you know, be honest about how she felt. But she was being restrained by her parents, basically, by her father. And then seeing the performance later on, of course, it was just the two of them on stage, but I just remembered that restraining, you know, and this is a time, you know, I was still relatively young. I wasn't as sophisticated as you were, clearly, Jules.
I'm not sure sophisticated is the right word.
But, you know, to have seen that physical representation and then to sort of, it made me kind of understand Ophelia in a completely different light, because we kind of were trained to sort of follow Hamlet because he's obviously the protagonist. He's the main character. We, you know, we follow him the whole way through, but to have actually seen a scene from someone else's point of view and to really see the struggle that she was going through in a very physical way, it was amazing. And I hold to this day that as much, you know, I've read several Shakespeare, but seeing it performed is really how you get the story, because these are stories, they were not made to be read, they were made to be heard. And the poetry and the music, it's so much easier to understand Shakespeare, especially for a dyslexic. It's so much easier to understand Shakespeare if you see it performed.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right there, and there is really something in seeing it performed well. I will mention just a tiny caveat here, and this is by no means a basis for anyone else's tastes, but I'm a dreadful intellectual snob when it comes to modern plays of Shakespeare where they have Juliet walking in Doc Martin boots, for example, and things like that, which shouldn't matter because the costumes and the sets of Shakespeare's time would have been very rudimentary. But I'm sorry, yeah. I just cannot get my head round it. It irritates me so much I can't concentrate.
See, that's because I have seen a few kind of more modern interpretations of Shakespeare stories. For instance, there was the Macbeth with Patrick Stewart, set in this kind of war thing, and the witches were actually nurses, and they were terrifying. And I felt that it brought it forward a little bit, because there are themes within Macbeth, and we've discussed this, but there are themes within Macbeth which don't translate because they were written for, or motifs rather, in Macbeth, which don't translate because they were written for a certain kind of audience. And, you know, we've mentioned before that the equivalent of witch back then to now would be probably terrorist. Being branded a witch was a death sentence. Being associated with a witch was a death sentence, in the same way that, you know, now it holds the kind of the same level of gravity. So modern interpretations can actually really show the themes of Shakespeare in a new way, because when we think about the witches now and we see sort of like old, you know, imagery of old versions of Macbeth, the witches are kind of laughable because you're like, yeah. And you need to really appreciate Macbeth. You need to understand how terrifying they really, really were, to the extent that it was banned. This was a play that was banned because James I was so freaked out by these witches. I mean, he had a weird obsession anyway, but, you know, so I actually kind of like some of the modern interpretations, but I think they have to be clever about it. And if you are doing a modern interpretation, it can't just be, oh, because we're doing something new. It really has to be so that you can tell the story in a new way.
Yeah, it's just to clarify what I said before, I'm talking strictly about theatre and strictly about a case of we've decided not to bother with putting any sort of context on it at all. We're literally just going to say the lines. That's what I have a problem with.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And I think there's another element, which is that people hear Shakespeare, you're taught Shakespeare in school, and there's this level of snobbery that comes with it. And let me tell you, Shakespeare is like 90% penis jokes and puns.
Yeah.
Okay? He was a dirty man.
I think the thing is, he was writing for all levels of society, and you can take whatever level from it you like. Yeah. Alan doesn't like Shakespeare at all. He said it's basically EastEnders for the 16th century. I mean, he's slightly off there. But he's also not wrong, because in a lot of ways, the dramas and things, you know, someone's run off with someone else's wife, someone was supposed to get engaged to someone they didn't want, so they went with somebody else, scheming for power, scheming for possessions. All those things are all things you'd hear sort of perhaps in the news today. There wouldn't necessarily be great kings and princesses and things, but someone scheming to kill off their spouse. That, you know, perfectly normal yeah. level people. So
even exeunt pursued by a bear.
Yeah, I mean, it is actually, it's exactly, it is kind of soap opera-ish on that level. But yeah. really, it depends on what level you access it on, because you can access it on the level of dick jokes. You can access it on the soap opera level. You can access it on the level of moral complexity and philosophy. Yeah. So really, it's up to you. And yes, you can be a bit sort of snobbish in the sense of, oh, you don't understand Shakespeare. And it's like, well, again, you're only really seeing the top. You're not looking at the entire cocktail.
Yeah, as it because were. It's completely, as you say, you imagine where Shakespeare was performed and you would have had high society there, and then you would have had the grunts, you know, the people who paid a penny and would literally throw fruit onto the stage. You know what I mean?
You had to entertain them. You know, they wouldn't exactly. have understood the story necessarily.
Yeah, but you had to make sure that, yeah, that they could understand vaguely what was going on. And they could have, but it was also about, you know, it was that mixed level of entertainment. And again, coming from the point of view of a dyslexic person, reading Shakespeare is really hard, actually. It's difficult, and I really struggled with it. And even to this day, having studied drama and having, you know, studied Shakespeare quite a lot, I still struggle. I cannot really read new Shakespeare plays. I have to watch them first. Simply because I can't understand what's happening on the page. And you're not really supposed to, again, because these plays were not written down for quite a long time. And they wouldn't have really been written down in full when they were being created. You know, there would have been scraps here and there, and actors would have been told stuff, and they'd have learnt lines and things like that. And the plays would have been adapted as they were being, you know, set, put together. So they were made to have that visual and vocal element to them. So I think that when people get frightened of Shakespeare, I completely understand, because I was totally freaked out by Shakespeare, simply because of the age of the language and the poetry and the strangeness of it, because it is a little bit strange. It's very stylized. But I urge you to watch a version of it, and don't think of, you know, the very classical, very typical kind of versions that you can get. One of the best Hamlets that I recommend people watch is watch the David Tennant Hamlet. I think you can find it on YouTube, and it's brilliant. It's really, really good. I love the way they do it, and I really like the way they express the characters. It feels very realistic.
I'm going to come at it from a slightly different angle, because yes, I can completely see your point. And just for anybody who isn't dyslexic and just finds it just doesn't come easily for them.
Yeah.
I, for a long time, thought it just came naturally to me because I started really young, because I was that desperate for something to read. And then I realised I had lexical synesthesia, which means that I see and associate letters with different colours, words have tastes, etc, etc. It's nothing really special, but it does mean that I can look at words in sometimes even in different languages that I don't understand and get the gist of it just because of this weird quirk of my brain. And I don't have very many advantages with my brain, so I'm inclined to make the most of the ones that are actually advantageous. So it's no weirder to say, you know what, I looked at it and I did understand it, and I can't understand what anyone else is going on about when they say that they can't follow what's being said. The first play we studied at school for Shakespeare was A Midsummer Night's Dream.
Mm-hmm.
Now, aside from the fact that this was at a convent school, and at the beginning of that class, the nun who was acting as headmistress at the time came in, told us all to take out our rulers, and then read down a long list of things we had to cross out in our books not to study, because they were references to sex. So actually, it made the play quite a bit shorter for a start.
Yep.
But also, I found that even though I was in the top set for that class, that people were complaining that they couldn't understand what was going on, and I thought there was something wrong with me, because I actually could. But it wasn't a case of intelligence, it was genuinely just a case of seeing words differently written down. It kind of sucks for people if you have had to struggle through Shakespeare and Chaucer and maybe even Old English at school, but at the same time, on the other end of the scale, you're not weird if you do get it as well.
Yeah, no, I'm not. You're a freak, Jewel. No, I'm just.
I am, but probably not over this.
Yeah, not for this reason, for other reasons.
Undisclosed.
That's for another episode, where we talk about your kink.
Could we stop bringing that up?
Oh, cable knit sweaters. I'm sorry.
I'll write you a sonnet in 6 and 8 and make you say it aloud.
Okay, challenge accepted.
Future episode, guys, watch out for it.
We're just going to have an episode of challenges for each other, aren't we?
At this rate, yes.
Okay.
So, what does Shakespeare say to a modern audience? I think in some ways the reason it still resonates now, sort of 400 or 500 years later, not quite 500 years, but, is the fact that the themes are universal and highly translatable.
Yeah.
He must have been a fairly open-minded and, more importantly, a logical person in order for them to be so translatable. Because if you look at things by Marlowe, if you look at things written by the Jacobean... Have you read any Jacobean playwrights? They're bloody awful. They're so misogynistic. They don't translate well because the authors weren't terribly logical themselves. I'm sure they thought they were at the time. But, I mean, Shakespeare's so open that, yes, you could say, oh, is there a bit of misogyny here? Well, actually, I don't know. You can kind of read it how you want to in that respect.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
The strange thing is, yeah, Shakespeare doesn't feel dated in the same way that other Jacobean plays do.
Yeah, and obviously the Elizabethan.
Yeah, sorry, Elizabethan.
We skipped a couple of hundred years there.
Sorry. I was confused.
That's my fault, because I made a huge leap there and didn't qualify myself.
Yeah, all this time travel is really confusing us both. but yeah, it doesn't feel as dated, which is, again, very, very interesting, because the language is very stylized, but the themes, as you say, are quite universal. And actually, Shakespeare was often questioning things.
Yes.
And it's not just about, it's about morality, but it's also about other things as well. So, you know, he questioned gender a lot, actually. Yeah. And, you know, there are a lot of theories that, you know, well, more than theories, that Shakespeare was at the very least bisexual. And that could have played a little part into it as well. But it is very interesting in that he actually has quite a lot of plays where the main roles are actually women. And he also has plays where you have women dressing as men and fully capably doing the jobs of these men, if not doing them better than everyone else. A good example is Twelfth Night with Duke Orsino. He has Viola pretending to be Sebastian go to Olivia to seduce her on Duke Orsino's part. And Viola is so successful that she actually ends up seducing Olivia instead. And it's I just like the idea that women actually understand romance. They understand what people want better than the male counterpart, in that you had Duke Orsino sending other men up to that point, and they were unsuccessful in seducing Olivia.
Yeah.
And I really, really like that, because it did play this whole part of saying, actually, what is it that women genuinely want? And that was a very valid question throughout. But also the idea that a woman is capable of actually giving another woman what she wants more than a man necessarily could in some ways. And so he really, really does play around with that. In fact, the only thing that that really Shakespeare doesn't question is that Puritans are arseholes.
Yeah, which, you know, he may have had good reason to believe at the time.
Yeah, like, I can understand that. It's just, they're like, and here we have the Puritan. being an asshole. But you know what I mean? Is that he does bring these things up, and he does question that, and he had a lot of gender politics within his plays, and he also had very strong female characters as well. He didn't always, they weren't necessarily submissive.
They were always well-rounded characters. Before any of this debate about strong female characters and what that actually means ever came up.
Yeah. They were strongly written female characters. They weren't just there to prop up the male characters quite a lot of the time. You know, they had their own agency. And you think about Macbeth, for instance. Would Macbeth have done anything that he did if not for Lady Macbeth?
Yeah. And if, I'll come back to that in a minute. But if you want to compare it to something like Spenser, who wrote The Faerie Queen at the same time, where it was deliberately a long epic poem flattering Queen Elizabeth I, which, you know, was quite sensible, because if Gloriana is your backer, it's a really good idea to keep her on side. She was a great patroness of the arts, but if you got on the wrong side of her, it was generally quite a bad idea.
Yeah.
But, I mean, Spenser's Fairy Queen has one female character in it that has any agency at all.
Yeah.
And that female character is actually a representation of the quality chastity. Well, you know, with the whole sort of romantic era type poetry and type things like that going on at the time. Female characters, in fact, characters in generally quite often took personifications of virtues.
Yeah.
Of the main character. And you could argue that Shakespeare does this as well, but he does it in such a way that you can read the characters as actual characters.
Yes. How shocking.
Going back to Macbeth with that, you could argue that Lady Macbeth, is actually kind of, the devil on Macbeth's shoulder. She is his id. She's his lower self, prompting him to go after power for the most grasping and selfish of reasons.
Yeah.
But then she reads also, again, as a well-rounded character with her own agenda.
Yes. She does. And so I think that's possibly one of the big reasons why Shakespeare is so timeless, even to this day, is that he was actually talking about things which were advanced for his period, but are still relevant in the way we discuss things today. I mean, okay, I'm not going to rattle on too much about this, but, you know, very recently we had this absolutely amazing vote in Ireland.
Yes.
Sort of the anti the eighth what is it
the Eighth Amendment,
yeah, the Eighth Amendment,
removing it,
yeah, concerning abortion, gender politics, and sort of the roles of women and their own autonomy and things like that are in huge discussion even to this day, which is, you know, and obviously it's not just that. You know, but these things are in huge discussion to this day. And so, of course, Shakespeare's still relevant in the same way that racism makes Othello relevant to this day. Say that, you know, we have a lot of these themes about sort of being in power too long and just wanting to get to be praised and be surrounded by sycophants and then being worried about being surrounded by sycophants. You know, with King Lear and stuff like that. We have a lot of issues which are still very relevant to this day, because I think at his core, Shakespeare wasn't writing necessarily about what was happening. He was writing about human nature.
Yeah, absolutely. And some of the themes are obviously explored in various other works through the centuries as well. But he came up with, you know, nature versus nurture, wit versus brawn, love versus death, folly versus wisdom, innocence versus experience, equality is a matter of logic.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that one's a really important one, because it's a case of, if you read it over and over again in Shakespeare, that if you marginalise one part of society, what you're doing is making society as a whole poorer.
Yeah.
That marginalisation, you are creating a rod for your own back. Think of Shylock in The Merchant of Venice, where he is an oppressed Jew who turns quite vicious, demanding his pound of flesh, etc. So they've created their own enemies. You will create your own enemies. And then, following the Greek model, Hamartia always plays a really interesting part, in the sense that there is always a fatal flaw.
Yeah.
So particularly in the tragedies, there is a fatal flaw. It's suggested that there is the fault is in the stars, obviously in Julius Caesar,
mm-hmm.
Which is actually a tragedy, not a history. But it's a case of he always gives you a moment where things could have gone the other way. So yes, sometimes circumstance is against you, and sometimes it's your own problem. It's your own fatal flaw. It's your hubris.
Yeah.
In Lear, for example, it's the desire to be loved above all things, to the point where he's not actually being logical anymore, and he basically hands his kingdom over to despots. So, it's utter foolishness.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, I honestly think that's why Shakespeare is so relevant. We were saying that. Before the episode started, we were saying that we could have a whole podcast just about Shakespeare.
Yeah, it would probably run to about the same number of episodes that we're now at. So.
Yeah.
So this is really just going to be skipping across the surface like a freshwater boatman.
What does that even mean?
A freshwater boatman is a little water aquatic insect. And it's sort of
with the little legs.
The little legs that sort of go over, and I'm quite fond of them because they're really interesting to watch. But they're so small and light that they actually walk on the skin of the water.
Yeah, I've seen them. We used to try and catch them. Aww. How lovely. What a lovely image. How summery. Speaking of summery, I'm just going to take a brief break to just discuss with the fact that Jules must be locked up in her house right now. Hissing
the sun's
at the sun.
Out, so yeah.
Yeah. pale little.
No, finish that sentence.
I'm not going to, especially because I'm actually sunburnt at the moment.
Thou purple hued malt worm.
yeah, neither of us can talk.
Insults. Shakespeare had an excellent line in Put Downs.
He did. He really, really knew how to pull out that wit. I mean, Shakespeare insults to this day are still legendary. I mean, you probably have a little bit of trouble if you pulled one out in regular conversation, but with certain people, you know, you pull out a Shakespeare insult and that's it. They're done for the day, you know.
Some of them are very usable now. It's like, you speak an infinite deal of nothing.
Yes. All the ones that I had in my head have now vanished. See, this is an example. Jules throws one Shakespearean insult at me, and that's me done for the day.
I smackdown.
Smackdown.
Thou art a rare parrot teacher. I've always liked that one. But that gets turned around rather nicely in Much Ado About Nothing by Beatrice, who said, "A bird of my tongue is better than a beast of yours."
Yeah. Ah, oh, she's another great character, actually, Beatrice.
Yes.
Sorry, we could just analyse every single play. Let's look at the magical ones.
Yes.
The ones that actually have a little bit of spookiness in them. So let's start with Hamlet. Hamlet only has one bit of spookiness, well, two bits of spookiness in it, really.
Yeah, I suppose so, really. It's just the two appearances by the ghost.
Yeah.
Although I find the entire thing is, Hamlet used to be my favourite tragedy, and then as I got older, I kept looking back at it and thinking, wow, Hamlet's just really immature.
Well, yeah, he is, but you kind of do have to remember, he is actually meant to be a boy. He's not actually that old.
But even so, that was an era where you grew up a lot faster, or you were expected to.
Yeah.
So, yeah, like, I'm coming back round to it again, but I suppose the whole point with Hamlet is that he himself is... He's not really for that world, is he?
No.
He is the best of everything in a lot of ways, and therefore he doesn't fit in with anybody.
Yeah.
Well, certainly not with anyone in his surroundings. And in order to... I mean, you could argue there that the that human nature means that you seek out your own kind, or you will seek to destroy your environment in order to try and find it. And that's exactly what Hamlet does. He brings the whole thing crashing down around him because he's seeking some sort of meeting of minds.
Yeah. But interestingly enough, we look at the supernatural element here, and the supernatural element that you get in Hamlet is actually just an extension of that extreme human nature. You know?
Yeah.
And Shakespeare actually does that quite a lot, where the supernatural isn't necessarily just an external force, it's actually an internal force, which is why actually Shakespeare, in modern interpretations, it's very easy to make Hamlet insane, basically.
Yes.
To say that the ghosts and stuff like that are actually, it isn't actually real. It's a sort of form of hysteria in some ways, and that he's having a mental breakdown, which you can kind of understand if your dad was murdered and your mum was now bonking the murderer. Like, I too would be a little upset.
I mean, particularly back then, that would be exactly the same if your mother started having an affair with her own brother.
Yeah.
It wasn't a case of... they genuinely did believe that was that incestuous, you know?
Yeah. So you can really understand him, and he pretends to be mad, but there is this real element of madness about Hamlet, which also comes from this form of isolation and paranoia, that all ties in with him seeing his father. And if we look at hysteria, for instance, you know, you can actually remove the supernatural element entirely from the play. You can say none of that was supernatural at all. It was all just a form of hysteria, a shared form of hysteria between a group of people who were all very rallied up. Something maybe a little bit spooky happened. They all started going, oh, it's the dead king and stuff like that. And then, you know, this poor boy who's kind of been traumatized sort of falls in on it, and the next thing you know, it just escalates very, very quickly.
Well,
and I really like that, because I know we say supernatural, but there's a real naturalness, a very earthiness, connected with the supernatural in Shakespeare's plays, and particularly in Hamlet.
Yeah, it's the telltale heart again, because you have that element of a couple's own guilt is what's betraying them. And then you have Hamlet, who is isolated by the fact that he is slightly superior to everyone in his immediate surrounding. And that isolation usually is what tips you over the edge to a full and psychotic break. So back to madness. Proper madness.
Yep.
Okay, slightly more cheerful, magical play. Let's look at Midsummer Night's Dream.
Yay! So this is funny, because it's just about everyone being in love with the wrong person.
Yes. Isn't that a sort of madness of its own?
I think it is, because it's a whole night of madness, really.
It is, and I'm waiting for you to say it first, really, but...
Fairies! Yeah, obviously fairies and madness have long been tied within mythology, and you know, you have elf shot and all sorts of things like that. So it's no surprise that the fairies are kind of involved, and the fairies themselves are a little bit mad, you know.
Yes.
It's an extremely peculiar and odd play, which I feel like was almost on the verge of being really gay.
It's extremely bizarre. Well, yes, I think it was. It's also really bizarre in the sense of, when is it set? Because it's kind of set in ancient Greece, and yet it's not. It's taking characters like Theseus, for example.
Yeah. Where is it set? When is it set? That's actually something Shakespeare's quite good at, is that another reason his plays a lot of his, particularly his speculative fiction plays, can be removed, is that he sets them in places that are outside and beyond time.
Yes. It's not like Theseus has a massive part to play. He's just sort of like, we must have a kingly character. So we have Theseus and Hippolyta, the Amazon queen,
Yeah.
The most interesting interpretation I've seen that played is whereby she's not all, oh yes, my new lord and master. She's kind of like, yes, we're getting married in 5 days' time and I'm really not happy about it. And it's kind of like, yeah, you beat me in battle, so okay, I'm having to go through with this. But you can tell she's going to stab him in the back the minute he's asleep. But that's an aside. And then, yes, you obviously... The names obviously mean things as well. I mean, you have Hero and Helena.
Yeah.
Lysander. And, oh, God, what was the name of the fourth one of that couple? I can't remember. Demetrius.
I can't remember.
Demetrius loves your fair, oh, happy fair.
Such a nerd.
I know, I'm sorry.
I don't know why you're apologising. It's a very endearing quality.
What, being able to quote Shakespeare off the top of my head?
Yes.
Yeah, you can't believe how popular that has made me at parties over the years. Really. Oh, yes.
There's a lull. Quick, Jules.
Bring forth the fool. The sweet and bitter fool. Happily doth appear.
Hell, that would work at any party that I've ever held, to be honest.
Well, yeah, I mean, most people either tolerate me or they disappear. It's quite a good friend detector.
Will you tolerate me? Literally line by line going through the entirety of A Midsummer's Night Dream. Anyway, yeah, so it is this essential form of madness and the idea of loving. But an interesting side note about that play is about the fleetingness of love.
Yes.
And
absolutely.
Actually, about the fact that, yeah, okay, so there was a little bit of magic involved. But he kind of actually does play, have this little sort of mockery about young love. And the interesting thing about Shakespeare is that he doesn't say young love is not powerful. It's the total opposite. Shakespeare views young love as one of the most powerful, one of the most emotive, you know, forms of love that you get out there, to the extent that you have Romeo and Juliet who commit suicide because they love another. Okay, so he creates a sense of young love. I have to be with this person or I will die, or, you know, extreme depression. But he also portrays it as fleeting. And that's really interesting because actually you see a lot of fiction about young love nowadays. And I genuinely like the kind of the accuracy of it, which is that he never mocks the strength of those feelings, but he's very, you know, he does do a commentary of saying, but they don't last necessarily.
Yes, or they have to grow into something else. Tiny correction, I said Hero. Hero's actually Much Ado About Nothing. I meant Hermia. So there you go, too many H characters. Hermia and Helena, not Hero.
Yeah.
But yes, Romeo and Juliet's an interesting one, because in many ways that is one of the earliest examples of young adult fiction available.
Yes, it is. And it is young adult fiction. That's the important thing to remember. It is actually young adult fiction. Which is possibly why we study it in school.
Possibly. I mean, I think the thing is they expect it to resonate with you when you're sort of a 14, 15-year-old girl or boy. And I suppose it does in a certain way. But I have to say my tolerance for the story has gone down as I've got older.
Yeah.
I can also understand why... I mean, some people come straight from the angle of, oh, God, they were so incredibly selfish, committing suicide, etc.
Yeah.
But perhaps that's the only tiny bit of their lives they really had control over.
Yeah.
The interesting thing is it came from an Italian tale, which was told in a completely different way, whereby it's a cautionary tale about not falling in love. It was considered incredibly ill-bred to fall in love, certainly with the person you were going to marry, and then to run off with them and get married. That's the reason they ended up dead in this Italian tale. And Shakespeare took it and portrayed it in a much more sympathetic way, as you say, for young love. And obviously it doesn't last because they die.
Yeah. Again, I think this is another version of actually Shakespeare really flipping the expected moralities on their heads and saying that, you know, love was all big and, you know, everyone loved a good love story. in Elizabethan England, you know, and then you had the whole courtly love thing, you know. Love was in fashion, but it also wasn't a practical form of life, especially not in the upper classes.
No, absolutely.
And especially when it came to survival and stuff like that, you know, just getting married, the chance of actually falling in love and getting married and making a good match, you know, was quite slim.
Yes, unless you were extremely wealthy, extremely influential.
Yeah.
Or very, very poor, actually, on the other end of the scale.
Yeah. So, it's actually interesting that he tells this tale, which shows how that dynamic and how bigotry and groundless hatred is bad. Because ultimately, Romeo and Juliet is a tale about prejudice between these two people, between these two clans who are not actually that, who are very similar.
Yes.
And who are holding on to a hatred, which is never really kind of made apparent. We don't know really why they hate each other. It just seems to have been something.
It?
Yeah, what started it? You know, they're just doing it for the sake of doing it now.
Whereas if you'd married them to each other as to mend the breach, that would have made a lot more sense, wouldn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
In terms of, but no, nobody's interested in healing the breach. That's the thing. They're both really wedded to staying enemies.
Exactly. And this is, again, an example of the fact that we don't realise that Romeo and Juliet, and one of the lessons from Romeo and Juliet, which is learned at the end, you know, they say we've got to stop this now, is once again about prejudice. And this was a period in England's, you know, in Britain's, you know, time when there were extreme prejudices about between religions, particularly. And I think it's quite a thinly veiled chapter about that. I think that he was actually doing a very small commentary without being able to really do a commentary. But I think he was doing a commentary about Protestants and Catholics.
Yeah, I think there's certainly an element of that.
But anyway, we were talking about. We were talking about A Midsummer's Night Dream. I've just seen the time. We've gotten through two plays.
We've gone through three. Let's move on to one more and do another comedy.
Okay. What have you got?
No, actually, you mentioned Twelfth Night, didn't you?
Yeah. Well, we did. I did mention Twelfth Night. But we were going to talk about the speculative fiction one. So what's another speculative fiction one?
Do you know, I will mention this one is it's so incredibly weird. I think it constitutes speculative fiction, even though it technically doesn't have any ghosts or fairies, and that's The Winter's Tale.
Exeunt pursued by a bear.
It's utterly bizarre. After X number of years of, you know, this is a sad tale's best for winter, I know one of ghosts and goblins, and that is literally about as speculative as it gets on the surface.
Yeah.
And after X number of years of faithful marriage, the king sees his wife talking to his best friend and immediately assumes they've been having an affair for decades. Right. And his jealousy is so extreme and so out of, you know, literally so out of left field that it causes him to lose his daughter, literally, she disappears, his son dies, and his wife apparently dies. Now, it also, believe it or not, this is actually a comedy because it ends happily. At the very end, his wife gets wheeled back out, you know, years later. They find his daughter, Perdita,
mm-hmm.
who
was raised by a...
No, not raised by a wolf, obviously. Out in the wild somewhere. He's reunited with her, and then they wheel out this statue of his wife because he forgives her publicly, even though she didn't do anything wrong at all. He's caused all this problem with his extreme jealousy. And they say, it's a statue, and it's not. It's his actual wife there, standing really still, listening to him apologise. This is supposed to be set in ancient Greece as well, I will point out. Obviously, the marble statues used to be painted, but I refuse to believe they were that lifelike. But it's really weird. It's one of the four really bizarre plays that Shakespeare wrote towards the end of his life when he was seeing the death of the Renaissance and he was mourning its passing and the passing of the Age of Reason.
Yeah.
Along with The Tempest, for example. And a lot of people say that those four plays generally are really nonsensical, and they've got a point. They kind of are if you take them literally.
Yeah.
But they're allegorical for the passing of reason.
Mm.
So I think that's what makes them interesting. As I said, perhaps it's not speculative in itself, but if you read it, it reads as extremely speculative because it's so weird.
And again, actually, if you look at it, Shakespeare's speculative fiction plays, as we've said, are actually very much connected with, you know, bigger themes and internal morals. And so actually, you can say that they are speculative because they are still kind of discussing those general things. And the plays are nonsensical because they're thematic, actually.
Yes. I would say that some of the later, the last few plays were actually, the character development is quite sketchy, and that's deliberate because they represent virtues far more than characters, or they represent a state of being. Perhaps the king in The Winter's Tale actually represents the country.
Mm-hmm.
It's like you're throwing away everything that's been good so far for no good reason.
Yeah. Sorry, I'm very resentful to Cromwell. I know it wasn't Cromwell at that point, but you know.
It was leading in that direction. Yeah,
it was leading in that direction, yeah. Well, we've run out of time, Jules.
I'm not really surprised. You can't get through the complete works of William Shakespeare.
No, we can't. We'll definitely be coming back. I know at the very least that we have a few listeners who are very keen on Shakespeare as well. So I hope you guys have enjoyed this episode. Before we go, first of all, please do leave us a comment and tell us what your favourite Shakespeare play is. Or better yet, throw us your favourite Shakespeare insults. Deactivate us for a day. Go on. Just shut us down.
I will totally do a Shakespeare off with anybody who wants to. I'm up for this.
If you haven't already, please find us on Twitter, and you can find us on Facebook as well at Facebook.com/dissectingreaders, because I was very tired. and you can
that's
find
our manifesto to dissect readers.
And you can find us on Twitter at Dissecting Dragons. Now, before we go, it's time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation of the week. And this week, Jules has got one for you. Jules, take it away.
Yep, I've just read an advanced reader copy of Spinning Silver by Naomi Novak, who is better known for the Temeraire Dragon, His Majesty's Dragon series, and also for Uprooted, which is a sort of Polish-Russian retelling of Beauty and the Beast. Spinning Silver is, on the surface, a retelling of Rumpelstiltskin with themes from Earl Conig and various other bits and pieces in there as well, things like Clever Janet. It's so much better. It's even better than Uprooted. It's an incredible book, absolutely brilliant, and it boasts at least three main female protagonists who are in their own ways extremely competent. It's set again on the sort of Polish-Russian type border. And you've got people from all walks of life. You've got Miriam, who is a Jew, at a time when it was really unpopular to be a Jew, particularly a moneylender. Mm-hmm. And you've got Irena, who is a lady and becomes Tsarina. And you've also got Wanda, who is a farm girl and starts off extremely disadvantaged, and it goes on from there. And there are the, you know, there are their own fairies as well,
yeah,
in this as well, and demons and magic, and it is just amazing. I've always been a bit lukewarm about the fairy tale Rumpelstiltskin, but this is just such an amazing retake on it that everybody should read it. It's absolutely brilliant.
Okay, well, thank you very much for that recommendation. Do you know when it's coming out?
August.
So. Fantastic.
Put it on your TBR pile.
And on that note, we'll say thanks very much for listening, and we'll catch you guys next week.
Thanks and goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders, or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note that no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.